Welcome to Ekatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI.
Welcome back. We're diving deep today into, well, a really powerful and highly anticipated novel from the last few years, Liz Moore's The God of the Woods.
Oh, absolutely. A major work.
Yeah. And Moore is this writer who, you know, she consistently defies easy categorization. She's earned this reputation. They call her a cartographer of human frailty and resilience.
That's a great description.
It is, right, because she takes the momentum, the breakneck pace of genre fiction, that mystery, that suspense we love, and she weaves it just seamlessly into this fabric of, like, deeply empathetic literary character work.
Yes.
If you've read Long Bright River, you know exactly what I mean. That mastery, especially her focus on broken families, the shadows cast by addiction.
No.
It's all there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And The God of the Woods, which came out around 2023, 2024, it really has been lauded as the culmination of those themes. It feels like her most ambitious work yet.
She takes that intense psychological focus and sets it against this perfect massive backdrop, the Adirondack Mountains.
Right. The setting.
And the setting isn't just scenery. You know, it's ancient, it's sprawling, and it's fundamentally unconcerned, just indifferent to the human agonies playing out within it.
Okay, so let's unpack this then. But before we get into the plot specifics, the mystery itself, we really have to talk about something, well, frankly, bizarre that we found preparing this.
Yes, it's quite unusual.
It seems like there are two completely distinct, almost parallel versions of the core story of The God of the Woods out there in the, you know, the critical analysis and reports.
It's fascinating. Two different premises described for the book.
Right. Two very different lenses on the central mystery, both complex, both detailed.
And yet both have those core elements.
Yeah.
The missing child, the mid-70s setting, the Adirondacks looming over everything.
Exactly.
So we really have to analyze both, I think, because they seem to highlight maybe two distinct literary goals Moore was aiming for. Whether she ended up combining them or choosing one?
Yeah, that seems right. We can essentially frame these two narratives by their central conflict. Let's call the first one a narrative A. It's a deeply personal, psychological story, all about internal guilt, arrested development, stemming from childhood trauma. And the second narrative B, that's broader, it's more of a systemic critique, looking at class, privilege, social power.
Very different focus.
Very different. So let's start with that intimate tragedy first, narrative A.
Okay, narrative A. This one seems anchored in the emotionally devastating story of the Kelly family, summer of 1975.
Right.
And this version gives us a very specific contained world, a rustic vacation spot, Camp So-and-So.
And the emotional core here is 14-year-old Barbara Kelly. She's the protective older sister. And then there's her sweet, imaginative 11-year-old brother, Dennis.
The sources paint them as incredibly close. You know, this really loving sibling bond, tragically ordinary in a way.
Yeah.
And that bond is just shattered by an incident that feels so painfully real
because
it's so simple, so common.
What happens?
Well, it's a moment of, like, classic teenage peak. Barbara's distracted, maybe talking to a boy, and she just snaps at Dennis, tells him curtly to get lost.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And he takes those words literally. He vanishes into the dense forest right there at the edge of the camp, and he's never seen again.
Wow. Just like that. Those two words.
Two casual words.
And they become Barbara's life sentence, essentially. Her whole character arc, it seems, is defined by this crushing lifelong guilt.
Absolutely.
It sounds like a classic case of arrested development. Like a part of her is just frozen in 1975, stuck being the girl who sent her brother away.
Right. And she spends decades as this obsessive archivist of the case.
Yeah.
Always searching for external answers, maybe hoping to lessen that internal blame.
And what about the parents? How does it affect them?
Well, you see that same tragedy just metastasize. Gerard Kelly, the father, he's consumed by what you might call loud, active grief. He refuses to accept Dennis is dead. And this refusal turns into this destructive obsession with finding him, leading to alcoholism, despair. It's like his hope becomes its own kind of poison.
It's destroying what's left of the family.
Exactly. And then, in stark contrast, you have Diane Kelly, the mother. She embodies silent, contained suffering. She just retreats into this shell of stoic resignation. And the trauma becomes this thick, impenetrable wall between her and Barbara, unspoken.
God, that sounds isolating. Even their teenage counselor, Tommy Chipper, he gets caught up in it.
Yeah, he represents this kind of lost promise of youth, Barbara's first crush maybe. But he gets irrevocably tainted by the suspicion that falls on everyone during the investigation.
So how does this version, Narrative A, resolve? Does Barbara ever find peace?
Well, the resolution in Narrative A is described as brutal, mm-hmm. precisely because it's so mundane. Decades later, Barbara returns to the camp, still searching.
Mm-hmm.
And the heartbreaking revelation is that Dennis wasn't abducted. He wasn't murdered by some monster.
So what happened?
He followed her instruction. He wandered off to some secret, treacherous spot she maybe didn't even know about, like an old mine shaft or a hidden rock formation, mm-hmm. and he suffered a tragic, solitary accident.
Oh, that's awful. Just awful.
Yeah. There's a phrase used in the sources, mundane in its cruelty.
That hits hard.
Because
yeah.
there's no villain to blame, just fate, a child's literal interpretation, bad luck.
So the ultimate point, thematically, is about her confronting what?
It forces Barbara to finally grapple with the difference between responsibility, she said the words, and actual fault for his death. It mm-hmm. demands this radical, agonizing act of self-forgiveness.
Wow. Okay. That's a deep, deep dive into internal psychology, into yeah, guilt.
Absolutely. A masterful study of that kind of weight. But now, let's shift gears completely.
Right.
Because the second version we found, Narrative B, it just throws a grenade into that intimate sphere of personal guilt. It forces us to look much wider.
Okay, Narrative B. Here the focus broadens, you said, to social critique. So what's the setup?
Right. So here it's 13-year-old Barbara Van Laar who vanishes. Different family name. And she disappears from the exclusive Camp Owenoak in 1975.
Exclusive. Okay. Class element right away.
Exactly. And crucially, this disappearance immediately echoes an earlier one. Her older brother, Bear, vanished 14 years prior. And apparently, that case wasn't really investigated properly.
14 years earlier. Wow. So the premise itself immediately points towards class privilege, maybe systemic issues, failures.
Precisely. It broadens the lens beyond just one girl's guilt or one family's tragedy to maybe an entire community's complicity or at least indifference based on status.
So who are the key players in this version? The Van Laars.
We meet Alice Van Laar, Barbara's mother. She's already haunted by Bear's loss years ago, feels trapped in this loveless, maybe transactional marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Her arc is described as this painful transition from being a passive victim, using alcohol to cope, towards finally confronting some really dark truths about her family's history and power.
And the father, Lenny Van Laar.
He sounds like the quintessential entitled wealthy patriarch. His main response to his daughter vanishing is apparently focused on reputation management.
Protecting the family name over finding his daughter.
It seems that way. Using his wealth and influence to shield the family from scrutiny, from consequences.
And you mentioned another character highlighting inequality.
Yes, crucially, Narrative B introduces Louise Donadieu. She's a local woman, working class presumably. Her own daughter, Ruby, went missing years earlier.
And her case was ignored.
Largely ignored, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Due to her family's lower social status. This parallel story is vital because it starkly highlights society's calculus, whose children matter. Whose disappearance warrants a massive search in media attention.
That's powerful. So the climax in this version isn't about a personal accident.
No, it's described more as an institutional exposure. The mystery converges not just on Barbara, but on uncovering the truth about Bear's disappearance 14 years prior.
Ah, connecting the two.
Yes. Exposing the lengths the Van Laars went to protect their reputation back then, avoid accountability. And Barbara Van Laar's fate in this narrative is somehow inextricably linked to these patterns of exploitation, maybe even environmental exploitation,
yeah.
tied to the family's wealth and the control their money allows.
So the key theme here is explicitly class privilege.
Absolutely. Class privilege and the way wealth allows you to control the narrative. There's apparently a line that sums it up. Some disappearances matter more than others, and everyone knew why.
Chilling.
Ralph dictates whose grief is seen, who gets justice, who's shielded from the messy reality everyone else faces.
It really makes you wonder, though, if both versions, as the report suggests, end up in a similar emotional place, this kind of devastating sadness, accepting loss, did Moore really need two separate plots? I mean, doesn't Narrative B, with that added layer of social critique, just feel bigger, more ambitious?
That's a fair point. Fair question. But I think if we connect this to the bigger picture, what's fascinating is how Moore, regardless of which plot structure is the final one in the book, seems to use the framework of a cold case mystery to explore these profound truths, whether they're psychological or social.
So it shows her range. She can achieve that depth either way.
I think so, either through intense intimacy or through that broader systemic critique.
Okay, let's look at the common threads then, the unifying elements across these two reported versions. The setting, for one, the Adirondacks.
Yes, the ambivalence of nature. In both versions, those woods are central. a key symbol, described as ancient, vast, and simply empty of mercy.
Right. In plot A, the woods seem to reflect that terrifying randomness of life, just cold, uncaring nature where accidents happen.
Exactly. Whereas in plot B, the sources suggest the woods are being actively exploited, maybe by the Van Lier family's business interests.
So the tragedy there isn't just random nature. It's tied to human corruption, human greed.
Potentially, yes. The nature of the tragedy changes depending on the human power structures interacting with the environment.
And structurally, both versions seem to rely heavily on the persistence of trauma.
Definitely. Both reportedly use a dual timeline narrative weaving between 1975 and the present day.
And that's not just a trick, right? It feels like more rejecting the idea that time simply heals all wounds.
Precisely. Time doesn't heal, it just changes the shape of the wound, maybe. There's a quote from the analysis that captures it perfectly. The past wasn't past. It lived in every decision, every silence, every attempt to move forward.
Wow.
And in both versions, the official investigation fails initially because it's looking for something sensational, a clear-cut monster.
When the real story is quieter.
Much quieter. Hidden either in a child's literalism and a terrible accident, or maybe buried in family secrets and corporate dealings.
And that quietness, that empathy, how is it created technically? You mentioned the narrative perspective.
Right. Moore uses a meticulous third-person limited narrative. So we're tethered tightly to Barbara's guilt-ridden perspective in narrative A, or maybe shifting between multiple perspectives, including marginalized ones like Louise's in narrative B.
So it forces you, the reader, into their viewpoint.
Exactly. It's about immersion. You inhabit their limitations, their pain, rather than just watching the plot unfold from a safe distance.
And the atmosphere.
Oh, she's apparently a master of atmosphere, too. Using contrasting imagery, that initial vibrant, sun-dappled camp, that picture of youthful joy.
Mm-hmm.
Which is then just violently shattered and replaced by this pervasive dread and sorrow that mirrors the character's internal devastation.
Okay, so despite these really fundamental plot differences in the reports we have, what's the lasting emotional impact? Is there a shared feeling across both interpretations?
I think it comes down to this profound, almost consuming empathy and an ultimate resistance to offering easy comfort or neat closure. The final resolution, whether it's Barbara confronting her guilt, or the Van Lier secrets coming out, is described as devastatingly sad.
No easy answers.
None. It requires what's called a fragile, hard-won acceptance. You realize the point isn't really finding the neat answer to the mystery, but understanding the long, unglamorous aftermath of tragedy.
Exactly. The novel seems to force us to look past the sensational headlines, the initial investigation, and consider the decades of quiet suffering that follow. Long after the news crews leave.
Right.
It really pushes back against that cheap platitude that people just move on.
They don't move on. They learn to carry it, that immense weight of the unresolved.
So maybe the true mystery of this book and the really fascinating puzzle posed by these conflicting reports is how different narratives, different versions of truth can still lead us to the same profound emotional destination.
Yeah. The immense cost of unresolved grief, whether it stems from personal tragedy or systemic injustice, and the absolute necessity of finding some kind of acceptance in a world that feels either randomly cruel or maybe structurally rigged against some.
A really powerful lesson in how the story we tell shapes the meaning we find.
Absolutely.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Apatra Foundation.